Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Goldman Sachs before Congress. Senators hammered the bankers, quoting email after email using language not usually heard on broadcast television. Language Goldman bankers had used to describe just how lousy the products they were pushing were. Senators called it an outrage. The bankers insisted they did nothing wrong. The SEC is still advancing fraud charges, and behind it all, the great struggle over what will happen or not happen with the regulation of Wall Street, of American finance. This hour on Point, the grilling of Goldman Sachs and the future of regulatory reform. You can join the conversation. Were you cheering on the angry senators yesterday, listening to the banker's defense? Do you think Congress will pass serious financial regulation? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Sarasota, Florida, is Roger Lowenstein. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and outside director at the mutual fund Sequoia Fund. His books include Origin of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, and his latest, The End of Wall Street. Roger Lowenstein, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's always good to be on the show.
And from Chicago, Bethany McLean is with us, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, where her big recent piece on Goldman Sachs was headlined The Bank Job. She's co-author of The Smartest Guys in the Room, a damning expose of Enron. Her reporting on Enron helped lead to the company's collapse. She's working on a book about the financial crisis. Bethany McLean, welcome. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Roger. How are you?
Hi, Bethany.
So the whole country watching yesterday as the Senate committee jumped on all kinds of Goldman Sachs bankers. And I want to ask what you all were thinking about it, get some flavor of it. On the air, here's the committee chairman, Carl Levin of Michigan, right here, going after Daniel Sparks. This was earlier on before Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, took the hot seat. And here's Levin, Senator Levin, asking about an email written by another Goldman executive that used a profanity we heard all day, rhymes with pretty, to describe a product Goldman sold to investors.
Okay, you're trying to sell a deal, and it's your top priority. Come on, Mr. Sparks.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Should Goldman Sachs be trying to sell, and by the way, it sold it, a lot of it, after that date. Should Goldman Sachs be trying to sell a deal?
Well,
can you answer
again,
that
I didn't
one?
Use those
can
words,
you answer that one, yes or no?
There are prices in the market that people want to invest in things. I didn't use that term with respect to this deal.
Should Goldman Sachs be trying to sell a beep deal? And it, you know, rhymes with ditty, pretty, gritty, you name it. And we heard it all day long. And here, just a little bit between Senator Levin and Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein on what he thought of what his company did.
I'm just asking you a question. Do you think if your people think something is a piece of crap and go out and sell that, and then your company bets against it, do you think that that deserves your trust?
Many variations on the answer yesterday. Here was Lloyd Blankfein's to some of Senator Levin's questioning.
The housing market went south very quickly after some of these securities, not all of them, because some of them were done early, but they went, and so people lost money in it, but the security itself delivered the specific exposure that the client wanted to have.
Goldman Sachs CEO yesterday. All right, where to begin here? Roger Lowenstein, I've never heard piece of crap in a Senate hearing before, but we heard it a lot yesterday, versions thereof. What did you make of this back and forth? What was illuminated? What was not, Roger?
Well, Tom, I didn't even think we could say it on the radio, but since you've taken
once the
lead,
senator's gone there, his other we can't, but that one, I guess, is just now over the line.
I think there were really two dramas going on. One was the reputational drama for Goldman Sachs, and I think the testimony and the emails and so on brought out that it really is a different kind of firm, and Wall Street is a different kind of place than it used to be. Wall Street, Goldman was once primarily an investment banking firm, really centered on its clients. And in the 90s and 00s, it became a very different sort of firm, primarily a trading firm, one that, you know, is concerned with it making a profit, not its customers making a profit. And the old-time Goldman Sachs never would have, I think, you know, used these type of descriptions for products they were selling. They couldn't really fess up to any of this because they were fighting another drama at the same time, which is a legal drama. And for anyone at Goldman to have said in Congress you know, we're sorry, or we should have put it differently, or we should have thought again, would expose them in the case that they're waging against the SEC. So I think, you know, mm-hmm. Goldman couldn't really say much, and that's what we heard Blankfein and the others do.
Bethany, you've written recently that there are a lot of dirty hands here, a lot of, you know, no good guys. You wrote in an op-ed recently that the government was sort of one of the most dishonest and ultimately or worst actors in this, you've said. But yesterday it seemed as though the senators and the bankers were speaking two different languages. Bethany, what was going on there? Was it just kind of Goldman defending its flank against the vulnerability because of these SEC fraud charges, or are there two ways of looking at the world at work here?
Well, I think there are two ways of looking at the world, and it's when you listen to what Lloyd Blankfein said, what he's basically saying underneath the real commentary underneath this is that Goldman Sachs simply sits in the middle of two equally sophisticated parties, and everybody's a big boy, and everybody has their responsibility to do their own analysis on whatever it is that they're buying, and it's a free for all kind of every man for himself. And I don't think the Goldman executives would put it in that stark of terms, but I think that's the underlying gist of what they're saying. And I think what the senators what people failed to tease out in yesterday's hearing is that it depends on which market you're talking about. If you're talking about a market for, say, Treasury bonds, where everybody does have equal access to information, well, then, you know what, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And there I might be on Goldman's side. If you're talking about a market for mortgage-backed securities where Goldman, because of where it sits, as a banker to these firms, as a lender to these underwriters, to these sellers of mortgages, and as a Wall Street firm with access to information about the rating agencies that its customers don't have, well, then I think it's a different issue. And then I think it's a very fair question to ask if it's really okay for Goldman to sell these investments. And I'm not sure that the Congress people understood the difference between these markets.
I want to get into exactly that issue. Certainly Chairman Levin went on at length about some of these collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, that Goldman had arranged. And then he went in instance after instance where it looked as though Goldman was betting against the very products that they had helped put together. Here's a fairly long, this is a couple of minutes, so sit back and listen. But here's Carl Levin laying it out with Lloyd Blankfein's face kind of twitching in discomfort as he sat in the hot seat. And then I want to come to you, Roger and Bethany, to sort of disentangle this for us. But the chairman laid it out pretty damningly here.
On the $300 million Anderson Synthetic CDO, CDO is stuffed with New Century loans. These are known to be shoddy loans. I think it was one or two in the list of bad loan producers. A client of yours asked, how did Goldman Sachs get comfortable with this deal? In other words, pointing out that it was New Century. Goldman Sachs didn't respond and did not say, we're not comfortable. We're shorting it. We're betting against this deal. Ask a direct question. How can you guys get comfortable with a deal involving those loans? And instead of responding honestly, we got problems too. We're not taking any chances on this deal. We may be selling it, but we're also betting against it. That's not what happened. Instead, the client was told that Goldman was an equity holder, which it was at the same time, but that was a half-truth because it was also betting against that same security. That CDO failed within 7 months. Your clients lost, Goldman profits. The $2 billion Hudson synthetic CDO, Goldman Sachs was the sole protection buyer on this CDO with a $2 billion short. In other words, they were betting against it. A Goldman salesperson described it as junk, not to the buyer, of course, but inside. The CDO imploded within 2 years. Your clients lost, Goldman profited. Now, there's such a fundamental conflict, it seems to me, when Goldman is selling securities, which particularly when its own people believe they are bad items, described in the way these emails show that they were described, and to go out and sell these securities to people and then bet against those same securities, it seems to me, is a fundamental conflict of interest. And raises a real ethical issue.
Michigan Senator Carl Levin, chairman of the committee, pounding there yesterday on Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein. Roger Lowenstein, take us into this. As Bethany said, the Goldman people said all day, we're market makers. It's not our job to protect. But is this cool? Is this ethical?
Well,
to be making a market and betting against shorting the same thing you're selling?
I think Levin had very strong stuff. And you know, the question of whether it's legal, of course, will be hashed out by the courts. But we do expect of great investment banks, and particularly banks regulated and protected by the Fed, that they rise above the threshold of mere legality. We expect them to be honorable, I would hope. And you know, I think the test for Goldman is, did they disclose the facts that they would have wanted to know had the roles been reversed? And I think particularly, as Bethany pointed out, in a complicated, customized deal such as this, would they have wanted to know that the broker in this deal was short, that they were massively concerned about the reliability of these securities and the, some of the language that was used and so on? Would they have wanted to know in the Abacus deal that it was arranged by a short seller, the bonds were selected by a short seller? I think these questions may or may not get to the legal issue, but they raise very serious ethical issues, I think, for Goldman.
Bethany, we've just got a few seconds before the break, but illegal, unethical, business as usual?
I think the heart of the problem and the question I wish Levin had followed up with was, what access to information about this market did Goldman have that its clients did not have?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the grilling of Goldman Sachs on Capitol Hill yesterday and the future of financial regulation. Congress squaring off for the cameras with Wall Street. We'll also look at exactly where the regulation efforts on Capitol Hill are headed in this hour. Roger Lowenstein is with us. His new book is The End of Wall Street. Bethany McLean is with us from Chicago, contributing editor for Vanity Fair. She wrote The Smartest Guys in the Room, big book, big expose on Enron back in the day, and has been following Goldman more recently. Here is Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill yesterday talking about Goldman's, synthetic CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, charging that they were just gambling.
They're called synthetic because there's nothing there. You are the bookie. You are the house. You had less oversight than a pit boss in Las Vegas. You think it's so complicated, and you think you're so smart? Any street gambler would never place a bet with a bookie or a house with the record that is revealed in the documents that this committee has gathered.
Senator Ensign, who represents, among other things, Las Vegas, objected on the casino front, saying, hey, even casinos, in casinos you know that the odds are stacked against you. Here's a Facebook comment from Kate, Roger, and Bethany. She says, what bothered me the most was that the executives had absolutely no sense of ethics at all. They refused to admit any conflict of interest charges, didn't even understand that there was even the possibility of a conflict. One phrase kept running through my mind during these hearings, greed is good. Bethany, Roger says that if they've got ethics, they put the damper on them yesterday because they've got the SEC charges hanging over their head. Is that how you see it?
I don't necessarily. I think that Goldman has taken this position for the last 10 years, as Roger said earlier, that conflicts of interest are something to be run toward rather than run away from, that they can manage any conflict of interest. They put themselves in the center of a sea of conflicts, and they say they can manage them. And in some ways, this current hullabaloo is the inevitable consequence of that attitude. And so whether or not these are the right charges for Goldman to be confronting, it was almost inevitable that they were going to confront accusations at some point. All over the financial sector for years, people have complained that Goldman has conflicts of interest, that it can't manage, and that it puts its own interest first. And so in a sense, these charges are just that whisper and that underlying conversation among financial market participants breaking out into the open. And I'm not sure that the current SEC charges change that conversation one way or another. I think the real issue for Goldman here is the ethical one and the future of the firm and the direction it wants to go and has to go as a firm rather than the legal issue.
But the suggestion that the senators were making yesterday was that this really broke out into the open when Wall Street collapsed and the whole economy came down with it, that was the kind of expose moment. I mean, Roger, just I think a lot of people, myself included, still don't really know if are there legal guidelines, ethical guidelines here? Can you create a product that you're describing as lousy and then promote it, sell it, and at the same time short it, so bet against it in a very big way? Is there some circumstance in which that can be okay?
You know, Blankfein also testified several months earlier before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and he was a bit less under the glare then, and I think a bit more candid.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the commission that when Goldman sells a security, in other words, when it sells a security to a customer, and the security goes up, that they feel bad because, you know, there was a profit that Goldman didn't capture because the customer captured it. I think that illustrates the total shift that Goldman has made in the eras bygone. They were in business to generate profits for customers. As Bethany said, they are now in business to capture the profit for themselves. The you know, if you're asking about the illegality, it's going to get down to some very technical questions. What did they have a duty to disclose? What did they know? Does who choose the securities matter, or just what's in the securities? But I think it's clear that their ethical sense of themselves has shifted, and again, as Bethany said, you know, do they want to stay in that direction and continue to be that type of firm? I suspect that they're too far down the road now to shift. It's now a firm run by traders and dominated by traders, unlike in the past when bankers ran it. I think the Goldman Sachs we have, we can almost think of it as a hedge fund with a small banking tail. That's going to be the Goldman Sachs that we continue to have.
Let's go to our callers. Frank, Hilton Head, South Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I just have a comment. You know, we got decent Americans dying in World War II, World War I. We got soldiers right now losing their limbs, coming back in coffins. You know, if another country did to us what these Wall Street bankers have done, we would have declared war, Tom. I have a comment. Let's bring the soldiers home and send them to Wall Street. I mean, my God, are we going to sit here and let them ruin our country? So many good people have been lost to the cause. And these people, they sat there, I watched them yesterday, with their smirks on their face. I tell you, I'd like to be alone with them about 10 minutes in a room.
Soldiers fighting for a country and fighting for a system, and then maybe it's straight up abused here. I mean, how wide is this, Bethany, on Wall Street? Well, you know, Goldman was in the hot seat yesterday, but Frank's looking right across, up and down the street. Is this what everybody was doing, is still doing?
I think it is what everybody's doing, and I think it's what everybody has done for a long time. In some ways, I don't think that these conflicts of interest aren't new, and Wall Street, particularly in the bond markets, has always tried to sell things to its customers that it thinks are some of the words that the Goldman people used yesterday privately to describe their transactions. The difference today is the level of complexity. So in the past, a client, a customer, a counterparty, whatever you want to call them, had a fair shot because you could analyze a treasury, you could analyze, the client had a shot at being able to do the work. And I think to me that's what's changed, is that the level of access to information that gives Wall Street a leg up has been magnified thousandfold, 10,000-fold in recent years. And so the person on the other side of this trade no longer has a fair shot. And that, to me, is the heart of the ethical problem here, is that when the Goldman Sachs defends itself by saying, well, our clients, on the buyer was sophisticated, you know what? They're not. And the Goldman people know that. And that to me, is everything that's wrong.
So Roger, to our caller Frank's point, I mean, we've got soldiers out here fighting for a country and a system. Is the system working? Has it worked well enough with this kind of, you know, stuff going on for a long, long time? Or if not, is the regulation that's kind of coming together on Capitol Hill sufficient to address the problems?
Well, I think that caller made a very important point, perhaps indirectly, but he expressed, his outrage, obviously, and that outrage the Congress feels, and that's why we're having these hearings. It's not so the senators can express their shock that there was gambling going on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And to your question, what will they do with this outrage legislatively? The bill is, you know, somewhat like the health care bill, sort of a big, ugly bill. It does some things that I think will be wholly ineffective, such as a voluntary shareholders vote on CEO compensation. I don't think CEOs are going to lose a lot of sleep if shareholders vote that they're making too much money but has no teeth in it. The bill does some things that might be harmful, but if the bill comes together, you know, as it is now, it could do one very positive thing, which is to bring derivatives, these new financial instruments, or
CDOs and all the rest,
CDs, credit default swaps, which have been essentially unregulated, essentially free from any kind of capital controls, under the tent of regulation, and perhaps spare us from a future AIG phoning up the Treasury Secretary and say, hey, we're about to go broke in 24 hours because of things that were off our balance sheet and not disclosed on it. So if that were to happen, the bill could do one very good thing.
Let's go to Mary Ellen, calling from Medway, Massachusetts. Mary Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
I did watch a good bit of it yesterday, and I had a couple of things. One was I felt like they was a mixture of you know, Mr. Sparks looking contrite and Mr. Torre looking frightened, and then the other two gentlemen sort of a mix in between of arrogance and cold, stark fear. But
Torre, the like fabulous Fabrice Torre, saying, you know, I deny categorically, Tor, I guess his name, the SEC's allegations. But yeah, so what did you think, Mary Ellen?
Well, I felt like I tried really hard to watch this and avoid ideological prejudice. I just wanted to believe that with all of the resistance to the regulatory reforms, that there has to be some reason why, some justifiable reason why they would be able to sit there and say that they question whether or not they did anything wrong, which they clearly did. But I think the point that your guest made about what clients knew is really an excellent point, in that they said over and over again that they, Mr. Sparks said several times that they were looking to take on this risk. And I question whether that's one of those duplicitous kind of spin statements that they can just stamp on it, where really they're looking to take on risk to get more profit, but they really aren't looking to take on risk that has absolutely no chance of producing profit. And so they could not possibly have known that they were taking on the kind of risk they were taking on, it seems to me. But, of course, I'm no expert in this area. But
Let us pick it up right there. Bethany, what are you thinking as you hear that about who knew what about the level of risk? I mean, as you and Roger both said, Goldman's line yesterday was, you have sophisticated investors, it's their job to understand. At the same time, here are the emails describing the things as these big, huge bundles of bad mortgages as lousy, in more profane terms. So who knew what about risk?
I think Mary just got it exactly the key point. She says she doesn't know much about finance, but that was about as well articulated an argument on this as I've heard. So maybe this is one of those cases where it just takes some common sense, and that's exactly it. I think Goldman had access to information about the state of the mortgage-backed security market and the quality of loans that were being made that its customers didn't. And there's always been on Wall Street this kind of sense of the smart money and the dumb money, and the smart money are the New York hedge funds. And the dumb money are the big bank buyers. But the other part of the problem in this case is that the buyers often were seeking out AAA rated securities. And by definition, someone who's buying a AAA rated security doesn't want to lose money. So they're not in the same position as a hedge fund that is willing to lose money and make a bet. They don't want to bet. They don't think they're betting. And I think that's to me the heart of the ethical problem with Goldman's argument. I do not, by the way, think that this is illegal and that Goldman can be charged with breaking the law here. I just think it's unethical.
Let's get a question maybe on that front. Nashville, Tennessee. John, you're on the air, John.
Yeah, that was kind of to my point I was mentioning as well. You know, if you are a client and you let the client know that you have a chance of loss and gain, you're in it together, and that may be why the CEO yesterday wasn't really saying anything more than we're in exchange. It's up to the actual businesses to realize that, and maybe they did, and it could be companies that we have respected over the years that we may find are also a part of the problem.
But what if there's a chance of loss and gain, but what if the market maker has a very darn good idea about which you're buying here and is pushing it to you anyway while they're betting against it? Is that okay by you, John?
If you're associated with the risk and you know it, not everyone wins, but, you know, a good portion of people could.
Roger, I mean, we were coming back to this again, but it was kind of the nub of things in the testimony yesterday about who knew what. Is it fair for Goldman to say the stuff's lousy, but hey, if you want it, good on you, and we're going to bet against it and make a bundle on the other side?
Well, Bethany has pointed out the difference between these securities or these instruments because of their complexity and, say, on the other end, treasury bonds, and that raises the burden on a Goldman Sachs to disclose more, to explain more, if you will. There's one other reason why I think there's a greater burden on Goldman is, unlike with the case of corporate bonds or standard bonds, Goldman's actually structured these instruments. These instruments would not have existed without the connivance or at least the active efforts of Goldman to create them.
They built them.
They built them. So, you know, if they don't disclose, one can't know about them. I want to add also that as we talk about sophisticated investors, these weren't mom and pops, the law doesn't say that you're allowed to lie or to mislead a sophisticated investor.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain ways in which sophisticated investors are treated differently. They're allowed to invest in hedge funds, and mom and pops can't. But the law doesn't say and doesn't permit that you can actively mislead or defraud someone just because they're sophisticated.
Let's go to Sam in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for the thanks for taking my call. Several points I want to make, but I'll stick to one. It's my understanding that the way in which the economy is set out to work, it's to allow people the ability to their pursuit of freedom and liberty and happiness and all of that stuff. As long as the market was going up, nobody seemed to mind, and perfectly sensible people gave money to people like Bernie Madoff. Now, when somebody loses money, everybody wants a nanny state. Now, I disagree with your panelist, Bethany, when she says that people didn't have the knowledge about these instruments. If they didn't have the knowledge, why did they invest in them? Shouldn't they? Where's caveat emptor in all this? Buyer beware. And I want my market maker to have the flexibility to make an instrument. Even if I want to buy it, I buy it.
Sam, we've got it. Bethany, let me put it to you there, right there. Is the call for better regulation or more regulation, is that a kind of a knee-jerk, longing for a nanny state once we get into the loss column?
I think your caller raises a great point. And in most markets, from treasury bonds to other simpler markets, I think he's absolutely right. And that's where I think Congress went a little bit off the rails yesterday. I do disagree with him in this particular market and perhaps in others that are equally complex, where Goldman, because it was a lender to companies like New Century, which were originating these mortgages, because it had access to people at the rating agencies who were stamping these with AAAs that its customers on the other side didn't have. I think the bar is higher. I'm not entirely unsympathetic, though, to your caller's arguments, and I do think that he raises a broader point, which is interesting, which is that when the market is going up, all of us want it to keep going up. Regulators want it to keep going up. People want it to keep going up, and no one wants anything to get in the way, and yells at anybody who dares to suggest that things aren't perfect. And then after it all comes crashing down, we all say, "Why didn't you do more to protect us?" And I think that very real hypocrisy is a great point.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the grilling of Goldman Sachs yesterday and the future of financial reform. It's on Capitol Hill right now. Roger Lowenstein is with us today, author of the great new book, The End of Wall Street, sort of the inside story that tells how it all came down. Bethany McLean joins us from Chicago, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, author of The Smartest Guys in the Room About Enron. Also right now with us, James Homan joins us from Washington, congressional reporter for Politico. James, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be with you.
So Democrats have had something out there. They've tried twice to get it up on the floor for debate. Republicans have managed both times to push back with the help, interestingly, of Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska. We'll talk about that. But where is this going? Is reform rolling forward? Are the Republicans pushing some alternative? Is there going to be a backroom deal? What's happening, James?
The Republicans are pushing their own alternative bill, which the Democrats, as you'd expect, are just deriding as a watered-down version of their own bill. But there are a lot of negotiations that are continuing behind the scenes. Ultimately, the Democrats just need two Republicans now, because Ben Nelson switched, which we can talk about. They just need to get two Republicans to come over. And so it's figuring out what concessions or sweeteners they need to offer those Republicans to get them on board. It seems, based on what I'm hearing about the negotiations, that $50 billion fund, which the Republicans had called the bailout fund.
This is that banks would contribute, that would be brought into play if they, if some big actor, a big bank needed to be taken apart, and that money would then be used to do it, ideally instead of a publicly funded bailout, right?
Exactly. And it seems all indications are that that is out.
Now, why would the Republicans want that out? Wouldn't the is the alternative public money, or just don't help them restructure?
The alternative would be creditor and shareholder money. So it would be drawing down the equity of, mm-hmm. of the banks or the companies, or essentially that's what it would technically do. But they really don't want government to have this fund or to be involved in any way with pulling money from the fund. The Republicans say that it would put pressure on community banks who would need to contribute, but it would end up helping the big banks. But regardless mm-hmm. of who's right, it seems like Democrats have gone along with taking that fund out and are receptive to losing it. It also seems like the Republicans are getting some concessions on limits on the Federal Reserve and the FDIC's assistance for banks that could come in when they were melting down in the future. But even with those concessions, Bob Corker, who has played a key role in all this, mm-hmm. a Republican from Tennessee, mm-hmm. says the two sides still aren't very close, and other Republicans are more wavering. And so at this point, the negotiations are continuing to sort of pick off two Republicans.
Is it clear? Do they have a couple most likely in their sights, if it's not Corker anymore of Tennessee?
Yeah, we've been watching. There's seven or eight Republicans we've been keeping very close eye on. There's the classic maybe Republicans, Olympia Snow and Susan Collins of Maine, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who's been receptive to working. Yesterday, George Voinovich, who's an Ohio Republican, looking at he is going to retire this year, he said yesterday that he'll eventually vote to open debate. And Saxby Chambliss, who's a conservative but someone who's been willing to work with Democrats from Georgia, said that Republicans risk losing credibility if they don't vote for a bill soon. So those two senators are now sort of in the sights of Republicans. So is Scott Brown, the Massachusetts Republican, who's had a very high profile and who Democrats think that they can potentially win over and have won over on the jobs bill recently, because he's in this liberal state and there's a lot of economic anger in Massachusetts. So the Republicans are holding together for now very impressively, and it's sort of a classic prisoner's dilemma at this point, because Republicans don't want to be seen, many of them, as voting against Main Street as Democrats position it. So once two come over, you can expect a floodgate of 5, 6, 8 Republicans jumping on board.
Interesting.
But for now, they're holding together.
If they do get the votes they need to open debate, is it then a done deal? Is it then clear the Democrats can use, you know, their numbers plus whatever allies they find to pass it?
It really, the feeling on the Hill is that the bill is going to pass eventually, and it's a matter of when, not if. That said, there's no guarantee that the bill will stay in its current form. Once debate opens, there will certainly be a lot of amendments, and the bill still needs to go through conference committee. And Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, said last week that Barney Frank has been holding his fire and keeping his powder dry, and we can expect a lot of debate over what exactly the bill should look like in conference committee.
Could be strengthened, could be gutted. There's been a ton of money flowing around all this, and you've been tracking some of that. I mean, I keep lose track of the number that Wall Street banks have spent in lobbying, Goldman Sachs included, on this. What do you know about where the money's been going as this thing is being hashed out, James?
Well, big picture, we went back and tabulated just because we were interested and discovered that since 1979, Goldman Sachs employees alone have donated $31 million to federal political campaigns.
Is that a lot? I don't even know anymore.
Well, that's more than three times Lloyd Blankfein's bonus.
Oh, well, is that a lot? Who knows what he thinks?
Right.
But that's to Democrats and Republicans. I mean, where's it going right now?
Right now, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, who's been leading the charge against Republicans as being the party of Wall Street this week, he, in the first quarter of this year alone, took $28,400 from Goldman executives. just between the beginning of January and the end of March. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of money that's been flowing into the banking committee. What's interesting is that the hearing yesterday was in an investigative subcommittee chaired by Carl Levin from Michigan, mm-hmm. not the banking committee where you would normally expect a hearing like this to happen. And so a lot of the Democrats and Republicans have far fewer connections and way less money over time because the banks haven't had to worry about these folks.
But what are you suggesting, that they didn't put it in the banking committee because that committee's been bought off?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. It's perfectly reasonable that the investigative subcommittee would have mm-hmm. oversight here, mm-hmm. and Levin has been working on this investigation for 14 or 15 months, so it's not like they've just kind of created the Goldman investigation out of whole cloth. Irrespective of what was going on with the SEC's timetable, the Senate investigators have been looking at them. It's just noteworthy that if the banking committee had had a similar hearing, a lot more of those senators would have much deeper ties to Goldman and the whole industry.
I want to get Roger Lowenstein and Bethany McLean on this $50 billion fund out, if that's what's happening. But let me just ask you on this detail first of Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska. And he's the one who, I mean, he's the Democrat who bolted on this, so they couldn't get this to floor for debate. And he said that he did it, that he voted against his own party's push here because he believed that there was a problem with the derivatives, the retroactive regulation of derivatives, that it was unconstitutional. That's a view that's been pushed by Warren Buffett, whose Berkshire Hathaway is in Nebraska. What are the connections there, James?
Well, Berkshire Hathaway has also been Nelson's biggest contributor, you know, its employees. And in fact, according to the latest financial disclosure form, Ben Nelson and his wife own about $6 million in Berkshire and Hathaway stock. Ben Nelson says that's not why, and he's opposing it, but there's definitely a sense on the Hill and among Democratic leadership that Nelson has changed because he's upset about some provisions of the bill that were dropped, which disadvantage Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett.
The Wall Street Journal came out with those with Senator Nelson's financial connections to Warren right. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway on Tuesday. Okay, Roger and Bethany, if this $50 billion fund, and this would be contributed by banks, you can describe its function better than I, but if it's out, Roger, what does that mean?
Tom, I think it's somewhat naive for the Senate to be planning now for how financial regulators will deal with the next crisis, say 2015, 2020, who knows when it comes. They can write into the law anything they want to about not bailing out whoever, not using government funds. But when the moment of crisis hits, you know, 1980, we decided to bail out Chrysler, 1998, the Fed orchestrated a bailout of a private hedge fund, and obviously
right.
in 2008, so many. In a crisis, when there's either great political concern or great economic distress, they're going to find a way to do it in the future.
But I thought the idea here, Roger, was that when that crisis comes, if it should come, the $50 billion that wasn't public money, but rather the bank's own money, would be the essentially, call it what you will, bailout or restructuring.
True.
So wasn't that an effort to avoid a public bailout?
It is an effort, and I'm not suggesting that the $50 billion itself would be government money, but that's $50 billion. The TARP was $700 billion, hundreds of billions of more to
yeah.
Freddie and Fannie. To think that would suffice
kind of
for some
leaf.
Future crisis, I just think if when a crisis hits, the government, whoever's in the government then, will be on the line. They're going to be hard-pressed not to act because of what senators said in 2009 or 10.
Bethany, I want to get you on this. Let's get a call from Carl in St. John's, Michigan. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm glad you guys are talking about the bailout because I think that's really the crux of this whole situation. I guess I would say that there's been a lot of talk from your guests about how people who were buying these things from Goldman Sachs should have had Goldman is saying they should have had the information and, you know, they know it, they should have known it's risky. And if it were just as simple about personal people making bad investments and losing money, that'd be one thing. But this is a case where you have people did this probably definitely unethically, borderline illegally by Goldman and Sachs, because a broker the deal. And then the government or these organizations are deemed too big to fail, so you have basically public money or taxpayer dollars, our money, bailing out these bad business practices.
Heads they win, tails we lose. Yeah.
Sorry?
Heads they win, tails we lose kind of dynamic.
Right. I mean, but it needs to kind of, I think that's important, you know, to say that, well, maybe it wasn't illegal for Goldman Sachs to do this. Well, it's a bigger, it's a little bit bigger picture than that, because if it were just, you know, a bunch of people who were investing and they just lost their money, that's fine, or that's sad, and that happens. But everything crashed, and then in response to the crash, the taxpayers and our children and grandchildren, quote-unquote, are now bearing the brunt of this, we're going to bail out these companies because of these practices. So I think that's why people are really upset about the issue, and, you know, and
yeah.
You know, senators notwithstanding. So.
Yes, we got it. Thanks, Carl. Bethany McLean, do you see us... moving away, if something is likely to pass here, James Holman's description makes it seem like perhaps something will, but we all know the kind of compromises that have been made already and more maybe down the road. You know, Roger says crisis will come again. Are we still staring down the pike at more public bailout one day? Can we not regulate away from that?
I think the only way to fix the problem of having firms that are too big to fail is not to have firms that are too big to fail. And all the discussion around having a $50 billion bailout fund or not having a $50 billion bailout fund, if the next crisis hits and there are companies that the government feels are too big to fail, then they're going to be saved. And the problem that your caller just highlighted is going to manifest itself once again. And unfortunately, I don't think there's any real appetite for making sure that we don't have firms that are too big to fail. And I'd add that's the other incredibly unfortunate outcome of the taxpayer-funded bailout, is that it made companies even bigger. And arguably, it kind of ties this whole conversation together in the sense that there's a hypocrisy at the heart of Goldman's argument that the market should be allowed to function and it should be allowed to short securities, when it was Goldman's own fate that was hanging in the balance. Goldman, along with the rest of Wall Street, lobbied the SEC and the regulators to prohibit short selling so that Goldman and the rest of the street had a better chance at survival. And I think to me that just highlights the hypocrisy at the heart of all of this.
James, I mean, the TARP that bailed them out goes back to the Bush administration, and certainly the Obama administration was left to administer a lot of that and be in the middle of it. I mean, do you see appetite for measures, maybe even up to, not in this round, but sooner or later, breaking up some of these big banks that we've heard from many on this show, Roger and Bethany, Simon Johnson and others, you know, that's the only way ultimately to get out of this bind? Do you see an appetite lurking out there maybe for a round two?
There is an appetite for a round two, and it, that may be the right direction to go, and the experts may be reaching some consensus on that, but that there's not an appetite in Congress. They're having a hard enough time passing the current legislation, and the Republicans are pushing for the round two to focus on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So I don't see it moving that direction.
Republicans put TARP together in the first place with Hank Paulson, who, of course, was a former head of Goldman Sachs under Treasury Secretary under George Bush. What are Republicans saying now, James? What about in their proposed regulatory reform? Just let them fail, or do they still have measures for rescuing or restructuring?
There's some division within Republican ranks, but most Republicans subscribe to sort of the unfettered laissez-faire free market approach of let it fail.
Now they do, but they didn't when the chips were down.
No, that's true. And remember, that first vote in the House failed, and then the Republicans had to come around when the market collapsed, and they saw what happens when you do nothing. So they're now, you're right. I mean, they've forgotten some of that high drama that we all lived through in September of 2008. The Republicans say that they want smart regulation as opposed to dumb regulation, but then when you start pressing them on what exactly that regulation looks like, it sounds a lot like the free market system that existed and the deregulation that existed.
Before it all melted down and it became so very, very public. James Holman with Politico, you're terrific, and I'm grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Roger Lowenstein, where do you see this headed along political lines? I mean, Republicans retreating back to laissez-faire, but isn't laissez-faire look the other way, dereg kind of what got us into this pickle?
I think it is. You know, I think that one of the huge lessons of this crisis, we never would have thought that we needed laws or regulations to tell bankers not to lend too much money, because After all, it's not in bankers' self-interest to lend too much money. But you know, bank after bank after bank and Wall Street firm after Wall Street firm after Wall Street firm lend too much money, borrowed too much to invest in faulty assets. So I think, you know, the lesson is that the Greenspan worldview that markets will always work it out for the best isn't right. And if markets are let to run too freely, the havoc that they can wreak on the rest of us, you know, we paid a price in 8 million jobs of ordinary Americans, so we need some regulation.
Well, it was some kind of show yesterday. Well, I'll be watching very closely to see what actually comes out on the regulation front. You guys are just terrific, and I'm very grateful to you for being with us. Roger Lowenstein, author, the latest book is The End of Wall Street. Roger, it's great to have you today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you to Bethany and James.
And Bethany McLean in Chicago, contributing editor for Vanity Fair, co-author of The Smartest Guys in the Room, just a terrific expose if you want to see how this stuff can all go bad. Bethany, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.